everybody. Welcome to the Django Roundup, episode number 5, brought to you by Lincoln Loop. I'm Kenneth Love. My co-host is Brandon Conkle. And our guest this week is the awesome Tom Christie.
Howdy. How you folks doing?
Hey, Tom. I'm glad to have you with us. I've been a fan of Django REST framework for a long time. So even before
Thanks.
The rewrite, I've loved REST framework. So I'm glad to have you with us.
Oh, cool. Okay. You're a pre-2.0-er then.
Yes.
A true believer.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm post-2.0. I used Tasty Pie for a long time.
Yeah.
They made it do horrible things and then got tired of that and switched to Django REST framework.
Cool. Tom and I can spend the rest of the podcast deciding whether to forgive you or not.
So. You know, I don't really care. You can forgive me or not. If it wasn't for me telling everybody to use class-based views, everybody would make fun of Tom for doing class-based views in Django REST framework. You know that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Brandon's image froze. That or he is completely in shock of my statement.
Oh, I was completely in shock about the random person joining our hangout yes. today.
I guess maybe I shouldn't have tweeted the thing I tweeted.
Did you actually tweet the...
Oh, look.
I did.
We got someone else.
So, let's talk about our first thing, which is Breach, which I feel like I should yell it because it's all caps, but Breach and Django's response. And I'll point out, there was not an official Rails response to this. Just, you know, mm-hmm. FYI. I didn't see an official Pyramid one either, you know. But anyway. So Breach is a, not exactly new, but kind of new attack being done on compression, gzip and SSL TLS level compression. But what makes Breach special is instead of attacking the request, it attacks the response. So basically everyone is vulnerable to it. If you're using compression, you are returning data that the user sent in and you are passing along secrets like a CSRF token or similar bit of data. So long as you fulfill those three requirements, which Django most certainly does, except for the compression, then you're vulnerable to Breach, and that's not a good thing.
Django actually does have a gzip middleware, so you'll have to be
it
careful
does.
About
it
that.
It just isn't, you know.
Not by default, right?
Right.
The paper that Jacob linked in the article was actually really good, the PDF document. It goes into really big detail, honestly. After the first few pages, I skimmed, but the first few pages especially were a great description of what's going on, why this is happening, and... It helped me understand more about the vulnerabilities.
Yeah, it's definitely really easy to read. Also, like I liked how the researchers are totally honest as well about, you know, they were saying, we don't really know, you know, like our attack, I think, what was the phrase? Some of our tactics are a bit blunt and frankly poorly understood by the authors. Like that.
It just works and they're not sure why. It's like most of us in programming,
right? We don't
right?
totally get how to... but anyway, no, my first response to seeing this paper, I don't know if this is bad, was, oh, that's cool.
I basically thought the same. Like, I read the entire, I read most of the paper, and I was pretty much going, oh, well, that's really neat.
Yeah.
I didn't know you could do that.
I think that's a natural response for us as developers. It's interesting the kind of crazy stuff you can do. Like, I had a very professional interest, of course, in the possibilities of Wi-Fi hacking, and so it was it's interesting to dive into that kind of stuff, and especially when you're looking at it as how can I protect my users from this kind of stuff.
We've all turned on Wireshark at least once. You go to a coffee shop, you know. Let's see what's going on here. I'm not saying you did anything with it, just you've turned it on.
All right, yeah.
No, so if you think you're vulnerable to Breach, which there's a good chance you are, the simple solution is turning off gzip compression on any of your data that's coming from Django. So you can leave gzip on for CSS, JavaScript images, that kind of stuff. Ideally, those are on a different domain anyway. Just turn off the gzip for Django. And Django, they imply that they're looking into ways to mitigate this. So I'm sure they'll come up with something.
It might be something that's just going to have to be specific to your application, though. There may not be a general way to prevent that. So we'll see.
My only guess for something they could do that would somewhat make it work generally is sending back secrets in a separate request or response.
Right.
But then you may have to re-architect how you handle the request response cycle, so that could lead to a whole bunch of problems.
Trying to figure out what counts as secret and what doesn't as well might not always be clear cut.
Yeah, the best example would be CSRF
tokens. Protecting
the
CSRF token is important, and clearly if you've got any kind of bank related stuff, then that's a big deal. But there might be other things where potentially they're exploitable, but maybe not at first sight. I don't know.
Yeah. You may not realize that it's exploitable. I mean, maybe it turns out that with your particular setup, having the IDs to instances in your database leaves you open to exploit through something like this, and you have no idea that that's the case.
Right.
And of course, a framework can only watch so far ahead to make sure you're safe. So,
yeah. And really,
anyway, it'll be cool to see what they come out with.
And it's really not a bad fix, just turning off gzip for your application server. I know in a lot of cases I've handled that with Nginx, not this gzip middleware, and it's not hard to disable. And then they point out an article from Hinnick, who we'll cover another one of his later, but adjusting your server's SSL ciphers, that's a good read too. So it's not hard to mitigate the risk here.
The attack. Yeah. Yep. I mean, and there's going to be somebody that's going to say, oh, but if I turn off gzip, it's going to slow everything down. Okay. I mean, which is worse, waiting an extra 20 milliseconds or exposing all of your customers' data?
And you made a good point. Your static media can still be gzipped as long as it's on.
It should be, even if it's on the same domain, it can still be gzipped.
As long as it's not served.
It's being served.
Yeah.
Right. But ideally, you have it on a separate cookie-less domain so that the requests are even faster to it. You get both more requests side-by-side due to how browsers handle domain names, and you'll get faster ones because there's no cookie banter back and forth. So, woo! Do that. DjangoCon 2013! They announced the conference schedule. Has some very familiar names in here. Lincoln Loop's got two people talking. We have Michael Trithall, and we've got Peter Baumgartner giving two talks on the first day.
Yeah, Michael's CSS preprocessors talk was originally conceived as a tutorial, and then it got moved over to a talk. And
other way around.
Oh, actually, okay, sorry. My mistake.
He submitted it as a talk. It got approved as a tutorial, and then...
I see, okay.
Got put back in as the talk it's supposed to be.
Long trail to keep track of, but anyway, that actually sounds like a really interesting talk to be part of. I'm interested in the interaction between Django and the front end tools, and so this looks like a good one to be part of. And then you're right, Pete's got a talk later on too.
Yep, Pete is talking about Salt, Salt Stack, which is, it's funny, everybody explains it as being similar to Chef or Puppet, but it's really not. That's just a small part of what Salt does. So I'm sure Pete will come up with a lot of very interesting tidbits in that talk. I know I've started playing with Salt a little more, and it does an impressive amount of stuff. For instance, Lincoln Loop has Salmon, which is built on Salt, and kind of works as a monet kind of thing.
It's the beginnings of one, yeah, and it shows the kind of cool stuff that you can do that you wouldn't normally think of from a configuration management tool. So you're right.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of interested on the second day. Moon Lim is giving a talk about how to learn Django the wrong way.
I saw that.
Yeah, well, I met her at PyCon and talked to her for a while at PyCon, and I think it's kind of neat that she's giving a talk at DjangoCon. I know she's fairly new to Django. I think she has a year or two. So
right. She's still.
So, what sort of thing is the wrong way? What's the talk summary cover?
I think a lot of it is kind of not knowing, like, maybe where to put some functionality, if it should be hooked onto a model, if it should be put into the view.
Okay.
Things like that. And then Django has a lot of moving pieces once you really start digging in. And so going, oh, well, maybe I should turn this into a context pre-process. Oh, no, wait, maybe it should be a middleware. You know, you start getting all these options, which a lot of us use for nefarious reasons, but which beginners get very confused by. I mean, I did a PyLadies workshop a few weeks ago. I'm doing one in a couple of weeks again. And one of the women that attended that messaged me the other day about Flask. And she's like, yeah, I like Flask because it has less files than Django.
Right.
Like, just it had just less noise, yeah. You know. And so I can definitely see there are a lot of places that it's easy to learn Django the wrong way. So that should be an interesting talk.
I think another, like, a really big thing for newcomers is even if you do have all the documentation at your disposal and even if you do have good learning tools, where do I find the community and who do I know who to listen to and that sort of thing. So, I certainly found the first time that I went to any of the DjangoCon conferences, there was this massive change before and after in how I felt about working. Mm-hmm. You know, suddenly you've met people in the flesh and... Anyway, so I'm not quite sure where I'm going with that. But.
Well, I think it's really funny. I've been to two Django cons, and at both of them, Russell Keith McGee, you know, always gets up and gives his State of Django thing. Mm. And I remember him always kind of ending it with a call to submit patches, to contribute to the project, to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And before I'd gone to DjangoCon, and I'd been like, yeah, whatever. And then I go to DjangoCon, and you listen to his keynote, and it's like, right. I should go submit some patches. Yeah. I should go work on this thing. And I still haven't done it, but I keep feeling that way.
And the sprints after DjangoCon really are a great place to get started with that. There's so many people there that are,
yes.
are there to help you get started and help you lay the groundwork for contributing years into the future. It's a great place for learning how to contribute. I agree.
Right.
Well, if Django seems daunting, they're usually working on other stuff as well. You know, there's a Fabric sprint, or previously there'd have been like a South sprint or something like that. So you can jump onto something that seems a little smaller, a little, you know, easier to wrap your head around.
Mm. But contributing doesn't just have to be patches as well, you know, like everything that people are doing to talk about their experiences or, you know, so a newcomer, right? I think it's very easy for us to lose sight of what's hard in Django sometimes, because you get, you know, once you've built up a bunch of experience, you get used to thinking that everybody knows how these different bits work together, right? So something that newcomers can do that's really useful is blog about things that they've found difficult, or mm-hmm. you know, and give
or maybe give a talk at DjangoCon,
right? Yeah,
as Moon is doing. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's funny. My most recent contribution to Django was to actually scare away newcomers. Pi Danny and I rewrote the warning at the top of DjangoBook.com to make it scarier. So that people would stop reading it. It did not work. I talked to somebody today in IRC that had learned Django through reading the Django book. I was like, did you not read the warning at the top? It's got out of date in bold type like three times in there.
I saw that interaction on the Django IRC today. That was definitely humorous.
There were two or three things that came up on Django IRC today that were, one made me want to cry. Others were kind of humorous. Yeah. If you ever think that people know all the stuff that you know about Django, go hang out in Django IRC for a little while. Answer some questions. You will be completely absolved of that illusion.
I think that's a really easy trap for us to fall into. Those of us who are using Django on a daily basis, it's our bread and butter. And it's really easy for us to forget how much we pick up along the way and how much other people haven't experienced yet. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. I love that you jump into the Django IRC and help out. I think more people should do that, myself included. And I'm glad to see that happening more.
It, you know, it's a little bit of karma. I don't personally believe in karma, but helping people is never a bad thing. And, you know, I've found just by helping people, by asking questions, writing blog posts, you end up meeting people that know way more than you do that mm-hmm. will help you later on. You know, it's a very good thing to do. Now that we've been all touchy-feely, let's talk about Doc Jason. So Doc Jason is your new thing, right, right, Tom?
Yeah, at the moment it's a little bit of an experiment, I guess. It's just in a very early draft stage. And what it is a hypermedia format. So at the moment everybody's building these APIs, and they're not restful, because they don't meet this particular constraint called the hypermedia constraint. And the hypermedia constraint says the messages that the server sends to the client need to be fully self-descriptive. Now, at the moment, servers are sending back these responses, and clients are built with a kind of implicit knowledge of how they can go and interact with the API. Right, so say you're using a client library for some service. The client has hard coded into it all of the different URLs that it needs to go and go to perform different interactions, or as well as just that, also it has hard coded into it which interactions it can undertake at different URLs, or which fields it can submit at a particular URL, for instance.
Right.
Now, people are kind of... So what that does is it introduces a coupling between the client and the server. And people are kind of dealing with this in that a lot of the APIs you're seeing now are starting to use hyperlinked relationships rather than just primary keys, but it's still kind of hypermedia light, right? It still doesn't, the messages aren't really self-descriptive. So
okay.
What DocJSON is the server sending back messages which contain hypermedia controls that the client can then use to interact with the server. I'm explaining this horribly, but
so let me try. I've been thinking about this. I'm really fascinated by this idea. I think it has some really neat applications. But just going down to just some basic level applications, tell me if I'm understanding simple use cases for this right. I imagine using something like this, we could start to build out a standard for example, social media applications, something like that. So you could build out a client on an iPhone or a web client or something like that that uses that basic understanding of the types of interactions that a social media service would provide, and then be able to interact with several different services as long as they follow that convention. So it wouldn't have to know the specifics of that service. It would just need to know the general conventions and be able to make use of that information and interact with the API.
Right. Except that it's not a domain-specific hypermedia format, right? So a lot of the talking about how should we build hypermedia media types is focused on, well, if we figure out a good standard for, say, I don't know, messaging, or a good standard for some particular domain, then everybody can agree to a particular standard for how you deal with that domain, right? What this is a totally generic hypermedia format, right?
Okay.
So what you can do is you write a generic client library in Python, and that client library can then go and open a URL on the server and immediately present to you an API, like a programmatic API for interacting with that service. And it's totally generic. It's not tied to a particular domain. It's kind of like HTML, but in JSON. So one way that I think of building hypermedia APIs is if you think when you're building web apps, you have this distinction between the CSS, which has all the style stuff in it, and the HTML, which has the content. Well, if you strip away some of the structure and the content, and all you're left with is just the data and the interactions that can be performed, then that's what a hypermedia API is.
I see, okay.
And at the moment, yeah, so the APIs that we're building at the moment are not really very rich because we're constraining ourselves to this kind of CRUD model. So we build in this simplicity of, well, we better make sure that everything's kind of consistent between these different URLs. Actually, if you're building a hypermedia API, you can kind of build in more richness because... Anyway,
it's a really fascinating idea, though, and it sounds like it could grow into some different areas that we don't even expect it to. So
yeah,
I'm excited to see you doing some of the early work on that. I'm loving the concept and hoping to see it grow later on. Yeah. I think there's a lot of open questions about it. I think it's going to take a little while to get it right, but yeah, this is a good step in the right direction. This is cool to see.
The thing that's really exciting is being able to write APIs where you don't need to write client libraries for them anymore, because somebody writes a client library once in a language and then everybody can use that for all of the APIs. So that's the exciting thing.
That'll definitely be nice. Speed things up, hopefully. Ideally.
Anyway, we'll see how that goes.
All right, our next thing is, I'm going to screw this up, Mikhail Korobov, maybe? Something like that? Released Django widget tweaks. It actually got created quite a while ago, but there was an update not too long ago that somehow brought it up to my attention. I don't know, something brought it to my attention recently. It looks neat, though. It's basically, if you're already using something like Django Floppy Forms, this might not be super useful because Floppy Forms replaces it on like the form level. But if you just want to be able to tweak the widgets that are being rendered for a certain field in your HTML, then you can use widget tweaks and have it render field. You can tell it what field to render. And then if you want to specify like a certain type, like you want to make the type search, or you want to specify how many rows and columns on a text area or something along that line.
I like this idea a lot. This is actually something that we approximate using include template tags with context. So we'll pass a context into an include to change certain things. So we've used this kind of style on several projects of allowing you to define different things about the form fields and the form itself, just passing parameters like this. So it's cool to see a more formal way of doing this with more capabilities.
Yeah, if you want to do it in the HTML, this is definitely a really solid way to do it. If you want to do it more on the Python side, Django Floppy Forms lets you do a huge, huge, huge amount of field customization, widget customization. So, yeah, they both like I said, it kind of depends on which side you want to do it on, especially if you're working in a place that maybe is a little bit more traditionally divided, to where you have like front-end developers and back-end developers, and the two don't meet. This would be a great thing to give to front-end developers so they have way more control on how forms get outputted. Outputted? And it's a word now. you know what I meant. But yeah, it looks pretty cool.
I can definitely see myself using it for, just the occasional little tweak here and there. I think, maybe not as kind of project-wide all the time, but really, really useful if you just want to, well, tweak.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know this is something you would implement on every single form that you output. I think that would be a whole lot of extra work. But yeah, if you just have that one little form that, you wish that one field rendered slightly differently, this is a good solution. Especially if you don't want to get your hands dirty digging into all the crazy internal templates that Django requires for that.
on a really similar thing, so I still feel kind of lost between what are most people doing with regards to crispy forms or floppy forms or a bit of both some of the time.
I was just explaining that yesterday. So they're not the same thing, and they don't do the same thing, even though they're similarly named with floppy and crispy.
So floppy... floppy forms is basically giving you control everything in templates, and crispy forms is basically you control everything in the form code.
No. Floppy forms. Floppy forms. So once Django 1.6 comes out, a giant part of floppy forms kind of becomes negated, or redundant. Because what floppy forms gives you right now is HTML5 widgets for your forms.
Okay.
So you have a date field. It gets rendered with type equals date as it's supposed to.
Fine.
Right?
Yeah.
But what makes this really handy is Floppy Forms makes it way more convenient to override the templates used for rendering individual widgets. Mm-hmm. So if you want to change the way that Django renders, say, a text area widget, or you want to produce a brand new widget that has your own custom HTML, like maybe you're using AngularJS and you want to have Django generate the fields for you that already have ng-model or whatever in them, you can go and override these templates in Floppy Forms really, really easily, or provide brand new ones. So that's kind of where Floppy Forms comes in, is making your forms a little bit more customizable. Crispy Forms is almost purely for form layout.
Yeah.
So you want your form HTML to be written in the Bootstrap style, because you're using Bootstrap and you want your forms to look like Bootstrap without you having to do extra work. That's where Crispy Forms comes in at its absolute bare minimum. Beyond that, it gives you programmatic control inside your form class to control how the fields are organized, laid out, HTML that surrounds them, which ones are hidden, which ones are available, all sorts of crazy configuration stuff, which is really awesome if you're building like user-generated forms, because then you can just introspect that class, start adding stuff in, do whatever you want, and boom, you have a perfectly valid form that comes out looking exactly like you want. I speak to that from experience. It was not fun to build, but it works. But no, the two of them work really, really well together. But yeah, a lot of Floppy Forms, if all you're using it for, which is what I usually do, is you're just using it for the HTML5 stuff, that's going to be in Django 1.6, so you can reduce one dependency if that's all you're doing with it. If you're using all the custom templates, then that won't change, and you'll still want to keep it around, from what I understand. All right. Valentin, Golev wrote an article for gun.io.
I'm still shocked we don't get hateful comments about our mispronunciations.
I have mispronounced names on podcasts for like 4 years now, or three, and I've never gotten a hateful comment.
We're lucky to have understanding listeners.
Yes, I have been blessed with understanding listeners. Anyway, this dude wrote a blog post for gun.io. He is the CTO of Upload Care. And the blog post is about how to create an image hosting service in 30 minutes. And it's pretty neat, actually. He uses the PyUploadCare library, which I'm assuming comes from his company, and shows basically how to quickly build from the beginning of installing Django to having the thing live, an image upload site. So like you would use for, you know, showing off a screenshot to a friend really quick or something like that.
Because that is one of the things that I still find is you think it should be something that's easy, right? Having a sensible image upload set up on your Django site. Mm-hmm. And then you start putting S3 into the mix and you've got a hell of a lot of settings to deal with, because you've got all of the media settings, all the static settings, all the AWS settings, any compression settings if you're using Django Compressor as well. So you've got all these different things that you're dealing with. You start uploading your media to S3 and suddenly you find that it all goes slower because it's going up to your server and then it's going, which sucks. So then do I need to start using queued storage? So maybe you throw Django queued storage in as well, and
Well, even better, depending on how you have it set up, Django storage is in Bodo. First, ping the server to see if that file exists or not, then start the upload process.
Right.
So you get two round trips to the server, not just one.
And when you start generating thumbnails off of that image, if it goes off and hits S3. Before the thumbnail can even be generated, then that sucks.
Yeah, there's a huge amount of stuff that can potentially go wrong in the middle of that just for uploading an image.
So yeah, good thing to build a service on, right?
Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah, and, I mean, seeing that there's a service like this that's built around that idea of making that easier, because you're right, that's a nightmare. I've dealt with that too, especially on platforms like Heroku, where you can't really use a lot of the local file storage. Now that's starting to change, but in the past anyway, it's been it's a lot of stuff to deal with to do something that from the outside looks really simple.
Yeah, well, I don't believe unless you have found out something I haven't, they still don't have it to where you can store uploaded files on Heroku. It would just simply be your static media that gets stored on Heroku. Because Heroku has a wonderful thing that if you don't know about, it's going to bite you. Every 24 hours, whether you push to your Heroku instance or not, your instance is wiped out and replaced. So any uploaded files that went into your instance are now gone. So now then that happens every time you push. So somebody uploads something, you push a new feature, their files are gone. But even if you don't do that, every 24 hours it gets refreshed. And so, yeah, that's a fun little thing that if you don't know about it, you go, wait a minute, where did all those files go? I just published that really neat article with all those pictures in it. No, you didn't. All right. Julian Philippe has a talk about this is actually from the San Francisco Django meetup of best new features and important changes that are coming in Django 1.6. It's not a super long talk, but it had some interesting stuff. I like seeing how the timeline has jumped. It's getting short, for the most part, getting shorter as it goes along.
That's definitely a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm totally on board with faster releases with not as much stuff in. That it makes total sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'd rather have solid new features rather than a ton of new features. I'm happy to see they're going to do Python 3 support officially. So, you know, you can start telling everybody to use Python 3, which is scarier than it should be, but it's there.
Have you started doing that on client projects yet?
I haven't done it on any client projects. The Django Braces library officially supports Python 3.3, but I'm not responsible for the testing of that one.
It's not a scary thing, right? It's just do enough packages support it yet, right?
Yeah. And right now, I mean, stuff like 6 makes that a lot easier. The only bad thing about 6 is it's not as easy as I wish it was. I wish it was like import 6 and hey, you're done. that's not the case. It's import 6 and then go replace a bunch of things with 6 dot something. And make sure you didn't miss any. So it's not terrible, but it's not that bad.
I think I have a skewed perspective on how easy it is because some wonderful contributor went ahead and did all the hard drafting for me.
Yeah, our first brush with Python 3 was somebody contributed a bunch of tests for actually all the tests at that point. But they included a tox setup that had Python 3.2 and 3.3 in it. And so we were like, hey, look, our thing works on Python 3. Sweet. and then we've just kind of kept it going since then. All of our tests pass, and it says it runs on Python 3.3, so I'm assuming it's good. That's my involvement with Python 3.
Kenneth Love's personal guarantee.
Yes, exactly. If it doesn't work, patches are welcome.
This constitutes a solid endorsement that you should start developing on Python 3 with Django 1.6 on this, right?
I fixed a bug with Python 3 on Monday, actually. Somebody reported it, and I think I fixed it.
I like that.
All of my tests passed. That's the best I can do. Right? I can't do anything else. Yeah, that's all I can promise. Yeah.
If no user's complaining and the test passed, then there is no issue.
Silence is agreement.
Yeah. Exactly.
I treat it as, you know, if no users raised an issue, there is no bug.
Exactly.
Existential.
Because if something breaks, you will hear about it.
Right.
I did the release on, like, when did we do the release? No, we did the release a while back. Never mind. I was gonna say I heard about it like the next day, but I didn't. It was like a week later.
I love the I love the Python and Django community that is so ready and willing to contribute fixes like that. Like Tom, you talked about, they went through and they updated your framework for you. I mean, that's awesome. I love the community that's very mindful of contributing back. That's great. Python community rocks.
Yeah, it's funny as a developer, and I'm sure Tom and Brandon can speak to this as well. You have an idea for a package, and you know, you actually build it as a package, you actually get it released on PyPI, and that's like this big elation, right? PyPI has your package. I can pip install my thing that I built. That's really cool. And then you get to the point where somebody tells you, yeah, I'm using your thing, and you're like, oh man, that's so awesome. It's this other, you know, little plateau. Then somebody contributes a patch to your thing, a new feature, a fix, test, whatever, and that's like this really big peak, because oh my god, somebody cares enough to actually send back code. And then the thing that is like, I just found it out like a couple weeks ago, but it's like so awesome, is when somebody builds something that requires your package. Uh-huh. You're like, you built something on top of my thing? That is so cool. it's neat getting these like levels of elation, and you know, knowing that you've given them to other people because you've built stuff using their things, and you know, it's a good community for making each other feel good. I just made it a lot kinkier than it needed to be. This podcast does not have a code of conduct, which is a good thing.
Moving on.
Yes, moving on.
Some other great features in Django 1.6.
Yes, there are. Tell us about them, Brent. What are they?
He goes on to talk about some of the database features, which I'm really excited about. The transaction management is fantastic. Oh, yes, yes. And the persistent connections is something that people have used third-party tools to implement for a long time, and then third-party plugins. So to see first-level mm-hmm. support for it in Django is fantastic. That gives a boost that I think a lot of people don't even realize how much of a boost that is on traffic-strained servers. So there's some great stuff there.
If I'm reading it right...
I was just going to say, I like that these improvements are things that I generally don't need to think about too much as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, database pooling is one of those things, like, you kind of turn it on and then it works and you don't really think about it anymore.
Yes.
It just works. Woo, great. If I read it correctly, the auto-commit being set to true on everything now basically means that all the model saves you do are more or less atomic now.
I think it's really going to depend on how you're using it, but
I guess not necessarily atomic, but they're way more expedient than they used to be, and you don't have to worry about having, say, your post-save signal getting caught in the same transaction, as does occasionally happen.
X equals more or less Boolean true.
You know what? Just for that, we're going on to the next story, which is sharing your labor of love, PyPI Quick and Dirty from Hennick. I almost feel like I have to have been doing PyPI wrong, because releasing my first two or three packages wasn't really that hard.
I think that you must have been doing it wrong, because it was definitely a challenge my first couple of packages to figure
out. They're all on there, and they're all installable, so if I did it wrong, I didn't do it that broken. Wrong.
No,
that download counts just a lie.
You probably had some good examples to look on, and I'm sure there were good examples out there when I was doing it too, but I was failed to find them. So it was definitely a challenge for me early on. And if I'd had something like this when I was first packaging together third-party apps, it would have been very helpful.
I don't think anybody really ever writes the setup PY from scratch, though, right? You find one.
No, you just copy and paste it yeah. somewhere else.
They get copied, they kind of mutate, you know, someone cleans one up a bit.
And you always have, like, six commits dealing with manifest.in, because you don't know what the hell actually goes in that file. What do these lines mean? What's a .in file, anyway?
And where the heck did my JavaScript go?
Yes, exactly. There's no templates included. But no, Hennick's guide is actually really good. It doesn't go into amazingly deep, drastic detail, but that's not the point. It's quick and dirty. And it does a really good job of... You could go from, I have this thing I want to package, to having it on the cheese shop just by reading this article and typing a few things in.
And
which
your
is
package
really nice.
Would include wheel support, which I was glad to see in there.
And it will include wheel support. You and I set up wheel support on our local systems last week, and I have been glad to have that on just little tiny stuff I've done. It's been amazingly fast to install things.
Yeah, okay, absolutely.
You noticed the difference then.
Oh, it's huge. Yeah.
I haven't tried it yet.
I don't know that it's it's not gonna like save the world and feed children in Africa kind of difference, but it's definitely a noticeable difference on how fast things install. Okay. I have projects that have, say, maybe 15 different dependencies, which isn't that many, but it's seriously like I could trash the VM or virtual environment and build a new one in, you know, a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot faster than it used to be.
But I've got an example that I just had recently. As part of the Dallas Django users group, we were talking about Wheel, and so I did a quick experiment with NumPy, and I cached NumPy, so I use a cache directory with pip so that the download wasn't going to be a factor. And I installed NumPy normally, and it took almost 32 seconds. And then I installed NumPy from a Wheel, and it took 0.38 seconds.
Wow.
Okay. That's an impressive difference. if nothing else, you can do this for LXML and not have to go out and get coffee when you install LXML. Because LXML takes, you know, 20 minutes just to install, so...
Uh-huh.
It's the worst. Especially on Ubuntu, when you can't remember which of those crazy libs it was you had to install to get the XSLT thing to go through, and then... You remember why you don't use computers.
or XML.
Yes.
Well, yes. Sometimes you can't get away from that. Hennick's article is really good. It does get you all the way to distributing binary wheels, which is the future, and you should all be doing it. So I still need to put my packages on the G Shop as wheels. I haven't done that yet. I'm a bad developer.
So also something new that I learned from that was there's a test PyPy.
Yeah, I didn't know about that either.
Really?
I don't believe anyone knew about that. I don't
remember what it is, but somebody set up an example for uploading your app to PyPy, and what is it? There's like, is it Tablib? There's like 40 different flavors of Tablib or something like that up on the real PyPy. And now finally there's a test PyPy that people teaching you how to use setup.py can use. So, yeah. I thought that'd be nice for messing around with occasionally. Maybe my first wheel will go up there rather than straight to the main repo.
Yeah, I thought it was funny on his comment about the test PyPI server that it gets cleaned from time to time, so your account and your projects may just disappear. And you just re-register them and then put them back up. I thought that was kind of fun because... who doesn't love their account just randomly disappearing when they're trying to test that hot fix release they need to get out?
Yes.
I'm glad we have a test server.
Yes.
Because it's very little, scary.
The little bump version utility that he uses as well. I'm not totally sure if I'll use it because it's such a small thing. But at the same time, it's kind of nice because you just run it and you know it's going to be consistent and you know it's going to do the tagging right. And, you know, you can set up your config file and make sure that all of your versions end up with exactly the same commit message. And, you know, it's just one of those little things that because you possibly do it so often, it's nice just to hit the button and it's done. And whereas if somebody submits a fix and you're kind of tired and you're like, oh, okay, right, better pull this in, push a new version, and suddenly you know, it's got mangled commit name and you forget to tag it and blah blah blah. So
your commit broke my production deployment, darn it.
Huh, I have a feeling I told you about something like that on Friday or on Monday. Pro tip, have a release branch that's not just master, and always forks off whenever you do a release. Yeah, that's a really good idea. I should have known that before I screwed things up. Anyway, Babel from Armin Roniker. This isn't new. This has been out for a little bit, but this is the new official repository for it on GitHub. And what it is it's a Python library that helps with doing internationalization and localizing of stuff. And it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it looks super comprehensive. The first thing that I thought I would definitely want to use it for is the currencies. Like, that's something that comes up a lot.
Yeah. And currencies are just pain to deal with. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Much like time zones.
Yes.
We all love time zones, right? Doesn't everyone love time zones? And silence. Right.
Tumbleweed. So. Tumbleweed.
Yes.
The worst, and it even kind of came up for this week, is trying to schedule like the podcast at times when guests can do it when they're from somewhere far away from the U.S.
Uh-huh.
So like you're over in the U.K., right, Tom?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so you're not terrible as far as like time goes. But then, like, we're trying to set one up with Russell, and he's in Australia, so it's, like, trying to figure out how far around the globe we have to go to get the time right, and that stuff's horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, we need one time zone all the way around the world, and if you're not part of it, too bad.
Completely right. Agree with that. And the metric system all across the world, and, yeah.
So, Brandon, you live in Dallas now. I grew up in the central part of the U.S. Is it confusing to you how the TV shows are always like 11, 10 central when they announce the times on stuff?
Wait, you watch broadcast TV? Like,
no, I did when I was a kid, which is when I lived in the central U.S.
Now, I do remember that from back then. It wasn't really confusing to me, though.
I always just thought it was weird. Like, I always thought it was funny that my time zone got a special, like, broadcast of the TV show.
But nobody else's time zone does. You're right.
Right. Like, why do I get a special broadcast?
Well, it's not actually a special broadcast. It's just letting you know that.
I know.
Oh, I'm just okay. Saying. Yeah, okay. Got
That's
it.
How it sounds when you're, like, 7. Okay?
Uh-huh.
God, Brandon.
That one just went right over my head.
All right. Our next one is, I am not even going to attempt this last name, but from Sergey, it is JavaScript and source maps in a Django app.
So, one thing I wasn't sure about this was the source mapping, right? That must be something that's built into the browsers that's new, right? That's
yeah.
not something that is specific to... Right, okay. So...
Yeah, that,
right. It's
that's
something
right.
That comes
so if you're
up
using
if you
older
have,
browser,
like,
it's not going to not going to be effective at all. But newer browsers can take advantage of
because
it.
Because I was particularly interested in, okay, can I start to use this with Sentry to get error reporting from clients' browsers? Which, you know, like with Raven.js.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that you could actually. You would probably want to... implement the on error method and use this to gather some additional information that you then pass to the call that sends it to Sentry. But it wouldn't work for every browser. You're right. You would see it sometimes and not others.
Right.
Yeah, who cares about those browsers?
Exactly.
Yeah, if your browser doesn't understand box sizing, I don't really care. Anyway. No, it's definitely an interesting aspect of especially more modern JavaScript development is, you know, dealing with these source maps, things like that. So
yeah, being able to see where the error is coming from is important. I've definitely had situations where we've seen errors show up in Sentry because we're using Raven.js and we just have no idea where the heck to begin looking for it. So this would be very helpful, using Uglify to generate the source map and actually getting some more insight. That'd be great.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
No, it looks like a very handy handy little tool. So, yeah, check that out. Yeah, what you got? You got something else? Look like you're gonna say something, Tom.
Well, I guess I was just thinking about, you know, every time we get another little improvement. Okay, start minifying your JavaScript because then it'd be smaller and everything is faster. Oh, okay, so now it's more complicated because you can't debug. So, oh well, let's build some tools to deal with that. Okay, so now,
right. Well, and then they bring in
everything
write all
just
your JavaScript
and
copy script
and
because
more
it looks
complicated.
Better.
Yeah, right.
It does look better.
That's all.
I will agree with the CoffeeScript looks better. I like writing CoffeeScript most of the time. But, yeah, it doesn't necessarily make things easier.
You've definitely got a point about writing fixes to fix your fixes that fix your fixes. And
yeah.
You know, the web was so much easier back in like 1992 when it was just, you know.
Back when we could use the marquee tag.
Black text on a white background. Some of it blinked. Some of it was centered. You know.
Have you seen the controversy? You just laid
things out in tables. Yeah, that was so much easier back then.
Have you seen the controversy about Firefox eliminating tags like marquee? And it was either marquee or blink. Yeah. I can't remember. And people are making a big deal out of it. I saw somebody.
People got upset. People got upset that Firefox removed the ability to disable JavaScript. Uh-huh. They didn't remove it. They moved where it was. So instead of being in your settings that everyone can go see, you know, a command comma or just go look at your settings, now they moved it into about config, I think.
Uh-huh.
Because the average person doesn't need that. So why is it in the settings for the average person?
Like marquee and blink tags, disabling JavaScript is a relic of a previous age. I'm with you.
Yeah. Like, most of the web, you kind of need JavaScript for the web to be good, to not suck. So, you don't want your mom randomly disabling JavaScript. Because then you got to help her figure out why her bank site isn't working.
And it makes all our lives easier.
Yeah, exactly. Because right. We can just go, hey, everybody has JavaScript on. You can't turn it off. Unless you're a nerd. So
I'm going to compile Chrome with the flag that indicates this JavaScript should be disabled.
Exactly. I'm going to compile Chrome with this flag that only makes it run, you know, SunSpider 1.0. I don't want any of these new, none of these new ones. That was the one true JavaScript interpreter. Oh, God. Imagine if religious wars applied to JavaScript interpreters. Browser rendering. Do you think we'll have a post-blink and a pre-blink Chrome camps? The battle with each other?
There's already people that are writing JavaScript shims to add the functionality back. So,
oh, it's ridiculous. Yes. It's so stupid. Just use... Oh, my God. All right, last link. On that note, this is Django Discover Jenkins, which I keep wanting to call it Discovery or Discovers, and not just Discover. Django Discover Jenkins from Brandon Conkle. Look at that.
Yep, this is something that I wrote last week, and I've kind of been cultivating it for a release. We've talked back and forth a little bit in Lincoln Loop about the different CI runners that are coming out, like Travis and Drone. And there's pros and cons to all of them. Jenkins is not the trendy choice anymore, but it still has a lot of value, I think. Being able to pull a myriad of stats with a myriad of plugins, when you've got stuff that you want some complex stats or graphing or reporting on, Jenkins is still a good choice for stuff like that.
Well, you can do anything you want with XML, Brian.
ZomboCom is going to have to be an Easter egg in every episode now. I think we should start carrying that forward.
You can do anything with XML.
I have to confess, I have exactly zero to say about this link because I saw Jenkins in there.
I see how it is.
I'm sorry.
You stopped listening when we mentioned Apache, is that it?
But in any case, you know, for people that are still using Jenkins for some of its statistics and features that you can't find anywhere else yet, we've got a project that I just recently set up on Jenkins that's using the Discover Runner, and I wanted to run the test on Jenkins the same way, with the same discovery and the same suite building that we have locally so that the tests will match up. And so I dug into Django Jenkins and found some things that were outdated, some things that could be done in better ways now, I think. And so I ripped it all apart and put it all together in a different way and streamlined a bunch of things and released it here for other people that want to do the same thing I do, even though Kenneth Love says I'm not cool anymore.
No. I absolutely loathed every time I had to set up Jenkins. But once I had it working correctly, it worked fine. It's a great little CI test runner kind of thing. But I hate the setup, so that's why I just use like Drone or Travis for public stuff, because it's just
and I pointed
so
out,
much easier.
I pointed out in our internal communication, it's kind of ironic that I am using Drone.io to test the Django Discover Jenkins project.
Well, you know. No, we use Drone on the tests for braces, for Django braces, and it works really well. I need to actually set up so it runs our talks test instead of just PyTest, but yeah, it works very well. It's a lot more customizable with less work than Travis CI from my experiences. Travis is a little bit more fiddly.
Okay.
But Travis has a matrix built in, which is nice, so.
I hadn't even heard of drone.io until right now. So,
Tom's
behind
like,
the times.
I hadn't heard, Tom's like, I hadn't heard about it until. What test? People run their tests? No.
I hadn't heard about it until a month ago when we decided to set it up. Like, we happened to find it and go, oh, this looks neat. And we were having problems with Travis. So, we're like, oh, let's try a drone. Oh, look, it worked. All right. We don't need Travis. That was like. Chris and my, that was seriously our entire discussion about which test runner we should use. Travis is what everybody uses. Okay, let's try that. Travis isn't working well. What else is around? Oh, here's drone. Hey, drone worked first try. Okay, we don't need Travis. That's it. So, I can't really tell you if there's strengths or weaknesses to either platform. I can just tell you that drone.io was faster for us to set up late in the afternoon on a hack day.
It was so, really surprisingly easy to set up. You gotta love that.
It is. It is. It's basically you point it to a repo and then you give it a text box full of lines to run to test that product, and that's it. So it's about as stupidly simple to set up as it could possibly be, which is really good for a lot of people like me.
Branton, what is it that you... which of the plugins is it that you use Jenkins for these days? Is it just for kind of coverage and generating graphs of that, or...?
I'm using the coverage, the pylint, and the JS hint.
All right, okay.
He's using everything.
Which...
But no!
Which, coincidentally, were the only tasks that I pulled over from Django Jenkins, so there was no partiality there.
Daniel Lindsley, our guest last week, would be very happy to see that you have both tests and docs for this.
Yes.
And your docs are more than just at to do. So good job there. we've had a lot of internal conversations about documentation stuff, so because a lot of it gets ignored. So it's good to see that it's there. So if you are using Django and Jenkins, and you want to be able to use Django Discover Runner or Django 1.6 to run your tests, then this looks like a good place to start. I don't know. Does yours take into account Django 1.6's new test runner?
Yes, it does. In fact, it does? All right. The tests on drone.io are running with the Django 1.6 beta 1.
Good. I didn't say something stupid. So, which is very important. This will be a good thing to use if you're using that combination of things, which is a pretty good combination other than setting up Jenkins. But if somebody already did that for you, consider yourself very blessed and then go use this package. It's not terrible. It's better than setting up Solr.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, at least Jenkins is graphical for most of it.
We don't have another hour to talk about Solr.
No, we don't have another hour to talk about anything. So, that's our show. That's all of our links.
Wow.
Tom, anything you think we need to talk about that we didn't talk about? Since you're the guest.
No idea. You tell me.
Enjoy being on that spot there. All right, then... we'd definitely like to thank Tom Christie for being our guest.
Yeah, my pleasure.
A lot of fun to have you on the show, and definitely glad to have Django Race Framework in our world, and looks like Doc Jason is going to be pretty awesome as well. So thank you for both of those. I'm Kenneth Love. My co-host over there is Brandon Conkle, and this has been episode number 5 of Lincoln Loop's Django Roundup.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Ciao.